and welcome to The Schism. This podcast is all about critical thinking, dot connecting, the nature of reality, and trying to uncover the truth about the world we live in, society, who we are, and where we come from. Hello, and welcome to The Schism. Today I'm joined by my co-host Adam.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a very special guest on the show, writer, researcher, and journalist, Johnny Vedmore. Johnny, thanks for coming on the show.
Yo, bro, I'm very happy to be here with you both and very happy to chatter away about stuff. I hope I can be enlightening in some way, shape, or form.
Fantastic. We've called today's show The Usual Suspects, and we're going to be delving into the history of some of the most heavily featured people that we talk about on the podcast, starting with the man himself, Bill Gates.
Oh, wow.
Now, there's a documentary on Netflix, for example, Inside Bill's Brain. And if someone's watched that, they might think that they know all there is to know about Bill Gates. But what kind of murky light can you shine on this guy
that well,
people wouldn't learn from watching that show, for example?
Well, that's it, isn't it? There's a lot of those. There's a lot of shows and lots of puff pieces out there. They can't even get many good puff pieces now on Bill because he's such a, like, he's such a polarizing figure. He just goes wherever he goes. He's awkward. He's nerdy, but he's not nerdy. He's nerdy in a leechy type of way. He's nerdy in a, he keeps looking at my daughter. Can you please get him out? But your daughter's six, sir. Yes, yes, I know. He's a weird type of sluggish character. So when I was what I do especially at the start was I kind of go to that realm where nobody else is going, and with him it was like they knew up to a guy called Joseph Stanton Gates in his family history, because of course he's William Gates the third, and then there's William Gates the second, and there's William Gates the first, and we've all seen that. Anybody who's seen his dad knows that, and heard anything about his dad knows that he was a eugenics man. He was into all of that stuff. They look like a rich Seattle family. Where did that come from? I wanted to go beyond Joseph Stanton Gates, and I wanted to go as far back as I could. And there's like a little gap, there's a little like break in between Joseph Stanton Gates and the truth, because a lot of people, they hide, these people, especially elites, hide all of their past, they hide all of their family histories. They don't want you to know that they're related to the same people as the other people, and they don't want you to know all of that. So it took a while to get into Gates. But I went back to like the 1300s, maybe a little bit before, maybe about 1200 and something. Jeffrey Gates, there's a William Gates all the way back there sometime, but then there's no more William Gates really up until Joseph Stanton Gates has his William Gates the first. I'm not sure if he called him William Gates the first. This is William Gates the first, and you have to call all your kids William Gates afterwards. Ha 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 ha. Says like Victorian men.
They do like doing that, don't they? Calling, like, you know, they would just call their sons the same name as them. They're obsessed with doing that, the elites.
There's a break in this story where they stop doing that all of a sudden, and there's a reason why they stop doing that all of a sudden as well. Because like you go back to Jeffrey Gates, and at some point in Jeffrey Gates' life, you have like a Jeffrey Gates, and you have like a William Gates, and you have another Jeffrey Gates, but that Jeffrey Gates is going to be Jeffrey Gates the first, and again that appears back down that line, and eventually that becomes Sir Jeffrey Gates as he gets lined up with some of the Edwards, King Edwards, someone along those lines. And then you have Sir Jeffrey Gates the second, Sir Jeffrey Gates the third, and I think it's Sir Jeffrey Gates the third who serves under the Fat King, King Henry VIII. And he's such a powerful guy back then. I can't even, you know, he's in the court of Henry VIII. His grandfather has also served in royal court. I get a feeling it's Jeffrey Gates the fourth, not Jeffrey Gates the third. But anyway, they've got this long line of royal, you know, they've passed, it's not just one royal they've been through. They've been through a fair few. And I think they get a feeling that they control the court somewhat as well. So they get a little bit loose in their positions, a dangerous place to be back in the 14 and 1500s. They align themselves very much with King Henry VIII, of course. They get riches from doing that. And then when King Henry VIII dies, they're the ones, Geoffrey Gates, so the direct ancestor of Bill Gates, is one of the pallbearers lined up against the coffin, walking Henry VIII's body through the streets of London. And then they become the closest confidants to his son, a little Edward, who's only like 9 years old, I think. He's going to last only 7 years before he dies of an illness in his youth. You know, there can be conspiracy theories galore what that was about. But basically, Geoffrey Gates and another guy take this young king's ear, and they're trying to convince him what to do, and they're trying to groom him, bring him up as a little, I know, Pygmalion boy, that they could do what they want with, make him the perfect king. You know, these guys always have the same sort of idea, was they're grooming their kings. You know, these guys are king groomers. That's what they see themselves as. They're from a long line of king groomers. And he didn't end well, of course. He dies in young age. And there's a plot. Geoffrey Gates heads up a plot along with his wife. I can't remember what his wife's name is. She's got a very peculiar name. It's his second wife. He was a bit of a boy, I think. Especially back then, you've got to be a bit of a boy. But then King Henry VIII comes along and makes every boy's dreams come true. It's like, you can divorce them, chop off their heads, woo-hoo-hoo, and it all got giddy. Geoffrey Gates IV got into that. And they try and install Jane Seymour, I think it is, onto the throne instead of bloody Queen Mary. And that doesn't end up well for them, because the next day after she takes the throne, she chops off their heads. Of course, they've got loads of kids by this point. They got Stephen Gates the first. I mean, these families, the Gates families, they were big families all throughout history. It gets like, it's, it averages out something like 6, 7, 8 kids per household, you know, which is something to say for Mr. Gates and his world population.
And they've got an heir and a spare.
And their ancestors had the greatest of times. They had the greatest of times. They had sex all throughout history, unprotected, babies popping out all over the place, and now they're like, yeah, you, it's all you. So it doesn't end well for them. They get their heads chopped off, and this is the point when the Gates family line go to ground really quick. I think there's a Eugene Gates around here as well, like
Schwab's. What is this time, sorry?
This is about 1555.
Okay.
In England, Coney Weston is where the Gates family at that point would go and hide. They would go into hiding. Jack Eustace Gates is the guy who is the head of the family at that point and is hiding all of these kids around and trying to stay off the radar. They spell their last name differently. They go by, they spell it J-A-U-Y-U-T-E-S instead of Gates. So they're obviously trying to, like, you yoits. It's like trying to stay off the radar a bit. But also, I mean, some of these guys did have funky spellings back then. But it would be obviously the family had to make a decision. Eventually, Queen Mary dies of terrible sickness, and her much more attractive and clever sister, well, attractive when she was young, I think, sister Elizabeth becomes the reigning monarch. She took the reins of power and left the people below her still in power as long as they played her game. She was very much like, I suppose, Margaret Thatcher with the Tory Party. I don't know. That might be a good example of it. She was a bit different, was Liz. She was a bit different than the rest of the monarchs. She wanted us to increase Britain's power in the world. She knew something that not many other guys around there knew at the time, that shipbuilding technology was about to change the world. And she had grand plans. I've now followed multiple aristocrats who get sent off by Liz to set up new colonies here or set up new colonies there. I did. There was a barrister called Barbara Hewson. Her family were of the Irish Hewsons, but she was about as Irish as an Englishman gets. Well, she was an English woman. I'm not sure if she was. She was the one who defended Jimmy Savile and Rolf Harris post finding out there's abuse on Channel 4, where she said that 13-year-olds should be able to sleep with grown adults and stuff, and that the law should be rolled back and all sorts of things. Yeah. So I did like a family history dive on her, and I got back to the same sort of place where her family's in York, and they're quite high up on the trade front, and Elizabeth comes into power and is like, you know, the Northern Rebellions could pass by, and they say, well, it's time to spread our people around the earth, so let's get this massive Hewson family and give them loads of estates in Ireland, and they go and start taking over barbarian islands, and then for the years afterwards you see how their families get seated into position as justice of the peace here, or the main vicar there, etc., in all these different areas. And they become just the power structure. They're the ones who are then judging these Irish people they're still taking over. So Liz was big into this. Elizabeth I was big into this. Send everybody around the world, seed Britain everywhere. The new world come up, you know. We know that there's this America. We need to start sending people there. And the Gates, this twitching family of paranoid people who were rocking backwards and forwards after the loss of their own empire for a while, and them all having to go into hiding in case they have their head chopped off. John Gates, one of the family members who also had his head chopped off alongside Jeffrey Gates, his ghost was rumored to still haunt the Beasley Castle down in Essex, it's still to this day the ghost of John Gates roams, headless ghost roams the castle and stuff. These are all relations to these people who are in power now, but we see their power differently, and we perceive their power differently, especially as we're coming up to the technocracy, because I mean, the technocracy now, the kings and the sirs and the knights of the realm are all people who invent stuff and are innovative in a way that we can't quite understand, because when you go on to later years of Gates and you work out what they were doing, a lot of it was like mafioso technology, rubbing other people, other inventors out of history and other innovators out of history. But going back to here, the family decided to run off to America. This is the point where they picked up the Gates family banner, started to leave Coney Western in droves. And within, I think it's only about 25 years, the first generation of American Gates are arguing with each other over like lands and titles in America and honor and stuff like this. And they were living the dream. They go and live in the early states. I mean, there's not many of them at the start.
And sorry, and what time period are we at now? So the Gates family is set up in America.
That would be just approaching like English Civil War time over here. So we're talking like between 1620 and 1650.
I mean, it's a remarkable history so far.
Yeah.
How far back and these monumental historical events that were going on. Like,
yeah, already, even if from this point onwards, it was pretty much just, you know, like nothing to report.
They were war farmers.
Yeah. I mean, it's a coup. And what they tried, they got caught doing a major coup of global power and got a death sentence and execution. You'd think that, you know, dramatists and the people making wonderful documentaries on the History Channel would be interested in something like actually looking through history and telling a bit of story.
It
like
certainly
this.
Didn't feature in Inside Bill's Brain.
There is a reason, I believe, and we can get to that fairly soon. Do you know, if you see a portrait of someone like John Gates back in the day, they're quite handsome looking fellas. Something happened along the way, you know, in the Gates
probably
family.
Inbreeding.
Yeah, I would think so. And I can tell you, I know a little bit of that happened, because the next part of the story really in that Gates family tree is Stephen Gates the First, who eventually have like tales about his coming to America, his family's coming to America, written in some books as well of the time. They set up a house and they did really well for themselves. So they had a couple of generations. Stephen Gates the Second was born and Stephen Gates the Third down the line. And each one of those families had like loads and loads and loads of kids, and this is what around this time as well, some of those kids are going to go off elsewhere, and have other kids and have other lines, and they're going to be the lines of George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush and of Harry Truman. So three American presidents are in that direct line from there. You can go to the actual White House, has it all published online, the different family trees for all the different presidents. And of course, it's easy enough to find out Jeffrey Gates the Fourth is in the direct line of through Stephen Gates of George H.W. Bush and of Harry Truman. So it's like,
so that's just mind-blowing. Like, you know, for how what a prominent character Gates is, how is this information not out there?
Yeah. You know, I love doing the family history stuff. I knew I had to start writing about this shit. It was causing me pain in my life. Like, I was just, I was saying to people, but look at all this. And they were saying, nah, it's normal. That's how things are. And I was like, no, it's not normal. There's something wrong. I don't know what's going on. And we're all going through that sort of crisis at the moment of like our lived realities are not what we actually think they are. And when you go and look into it, it turns out all of these guys are somehow connected and somehow related to each other. And I didn't realize that I would like have something where I could go and delve into things. And because I wanted to do family history stuff, but I wanted to do it about normal, boring people. Maybe someone would pay me 150 quid or something, and I could make a week's wage, a real simple wage for a simple man. And I could drink my tea and eat my bourbon biscuits and be happy. I was really surprised that I discovered all of this history is here and they don't want to discuss it at all. And of course, that makes me even more suspicious to what comes next.
Exactly. But I mean, you might be a very unique individual in the sense that no one else has actually researched this to the degree that you have. I mean, we listen to a lot of podcasts and I've never seen anyone go into family trees and backgrounds of the kind of people we're talking about to the depth that you have. Did you find it strange that, like, why has no one else done this?
Yeah, but there's, I you know, I found that strange about that. But then I started, by the time we got around to 2020 and I was writing articles for Unlimited Hangout, I started to realize that they're just not reporting on anything. Every single thing that's a big story is just sitting there waiting and no one talks about it until you've shown it to them because they don't know anything about it. And it seems sensible now. I look at it and I go, I spent a year and a half, 2 years thinking, what am I going to write about? I'll try writing about, oh, that didn't work very well. I'll try over here. I don't know if that worked at all. You know, and no one's listening to you at the start anyway. So you don't even know what people are really interested in. You don't even know what's interesting yourself when you start off. And then you realize that everybody is just, they're being caught asleep on duty. That's it. They're supposed to be writing these stories. People go into these. After a while, I've understood the whole process of how they go into universities and they get taught how to work for someone. And then they go work for someone and their boss tells them what to do. And it's as simple as that. And then they spend their whole life with their boss telling them what to do because they don't have any other time. By that time, they found their missus, they found their life, or they found some dark, devious thing to do in the corner in the darkness. And
now we're back to Gates.
Yeah, and then we're back again. And then the next generation is born and knows nothing else. It's just like we do not know what we do not know. And we do not go looking for often for what we do not know. And I think the reason why no one has explored this is because people must have explored this and they would have found what I found, which is the next stage in the Gates family tree. After a lot of these boring Gates, you get to around the time of the slave trade and when the slave trade was being fought against and actively lobbied against. And guess where the Gates family tree, the direct line of Bill Gates is? The name is Israel Gates. And Israel Gates is got, I know, it's like when I discovered that, I was like, ah, oh, you gotta be kidding me. He's gotta be a boy. They were from Funky Town, literal funk, religious Funky Town. They were from Newport, Rhode Island at the time where all of the different religions were being brewed up in this weird cooking pot of religious freedom. This one area. It was also during the time that he was active as an adult and working in Newport, Rhode Island. At some points during that period, 90% of all the slave trade went through Rhode Island. So you're talking the molasses would be made, stuck on ships, sent across to Africa, sold off. The slaves would be bought with the molasses. They would be sent back across to Newport, Rhode Island to be processed, etc., etc. Now, I am unable to find that tiny little piece that I know is there, because everybody in Rhode Island during that period were basically employed in the slave trade. That's where Israel Gates was. That's where he was sitting right at that time. And I reckon that's where someone, maybe who's got a little bit of extra time, will find that one of Bill Gates' ancestors was involved in the slave trade, because they're kind of involved in the slave trade anyway. The royal family in Britain back in the 14 and 1500s was hardly like free democratic example of human beings. That was serfdom. It's a history that goes on. And then, of course, then out of that comes 50 years down the line was Joseph Stanton Gates, William Gates the first, William Gates the second, and then Bill Gates pops out. And people concentrate on William Gates the first and William Gates the second. They like to stay up in Seattle way, but that only happened with Joseph Stanton Gates. And I think some of that was, oh, the wealth over on the East Coast is drying up. There's a lot of competition. It's time to move over to the West Coast.
So let's just sort of fast forward in time and just focus on Bill's mum and dad, grandparents, you know, like recent lineage. Most people don't even realize that Bill's parents, for example, had these links to Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. And from what we know about Bill's grandfather, he had links to the Nazis and Ernest Rubin, was it?
He was part of a tight camp of the people that were funding the university for Ernest Rubin to conduct some of the experiments that they're doing over in Germany.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, really, these technophiles, I suppose. Hey. They are
people desperate. That like having sex with computers.
Yes, I think you're about right. I think you might have hit the nail on the digital head there. Getting some digital head. These guys are real. They got on board with the eugenicist ideas, with the Malthusian ideas really early on. I don't think there was much pushing them. I think they'd already, a lot of these families were rich families or were no longer as rich as their families had once been under better days. And they looked back and said, grandfather would tell us his story about how they all did this and they all did that. And back when in the day we were sirs and we used to live in castles and, you know, and that sort of thing then has led them to resent these masses, the poor huddled masses. In that same, you know, I think it's really interesting. The population growth is the thing that they most hate. And I think that was what took away their titles and their money, because it's just too much competition. You have like eight members to a family and only one of them is going to get the title. And that's what they don't think about at that time. And a lot of these guys are often once related to someone who was rich, someone who was famous, someone who had some form of title. And they wish it could have been them who would be the direct ancestor. And the idea that too many people in the world is the reason why they did not get what they deserve.
Too many people that haven't got the surname Gates.
And in the right time, yaks. You know, the thing is that these guys, they will go into hiding as well throughout their life. That's what makes them hard to find, I think, for a lot of people. I think a lot of researchers may just give up. When they don't get a catch, I can't do that. I just keep going and going and going and going.
So what is the direct link between, let's start with Gates's grandfather? What is the link there with Nazism and what was going on in during the Holocaust and World War II and the Gates family?
I do not know. And listen, I can look into that further and look into that. Right. My knowledge on Nazi fathers is definitely on the Klaus Schwab front.
So what do you know about Gates's parents and Planned Parenthood and Gates being basically raised in some kind of eugenics cult?
Well, they got a bit. This is one of the things I learned from studying Schwab is that by 1930s, the eugenics movement and the technocratic movement were happening. They were kind of like, you know, they were separate, but people could see there was a little bit of crossover there at the start. You know, it's only now that we can see loads of crossover and it's completely scary and bending doom. But what's interesting is the technocracy movement and these sort of movements were originally a membership club, you know. And a lot of these guys get invited into their little groups. I haven't done, and I mean, I've watched James Corbett documentaries on Bill Gates. I come across him when researching other people. I did a bit of research recently on Barbara Marx Hubbard, who was very much a futurist and a weird one herself. She was, I would imagine that Bill Gates would suckle upon her and she would feed him her evil juice inside, because there's like pictures of her around with him.
Oh, but Hubbard, can I get pity?
yeah. One of my 13 mothers who lives in the closets. No, I mean, there's a load of weird people around that era, but I purposely didn't go through that because so many other people were already looking into that. And I find that even though I find new information, I find stepping on other people's toes is bloody hard. And
yeah.
It's not somewhere I want to be.
Well, I've heard David Icke, for example, say, and I'm not sure if this is true or not, but if you trace the Gates family tree back far enough, it actually merges with the Rockefellers. Is that true, or are they just very close to the Rockefellers?
I think what you have to understand, I think that the principle is probably true just because you have so many members of the family. They were roughly, before the Rockefellers really made their money, they were roughly in the same areas and they would have been intermarrying and there would be lots of crossovers. This is the same. This is what I'm saying. Like, you know, they know, these guys know their lineage. They know, they have it written up for them by very clever people who research in museums and other such like historic libraries and the like, and they get to know all of their ancestors. We don't get to see that information, so we don't see the crossovers, but there will be crossovers.
Are very close.
The families are very close, but they're very big as well, and you know, they watch out for each other. Of course they watch out for each other, unless you turn your back on the family. Mafia
style, yeah. I mean, it's definitely a far cry from old Bill Gates is just an ordinary guy, a geek in a garage that started up Microsoft and then become a billionaire, knowing these links with, I mean, we didn't even know
about the royalty
aspect of it. We were aware of his mum and dad, Planned Parenthood, which when you think about it, Planned Parenthood, what is that really? It's part of depopulation. And you could argue even eugenics, then you've got these Nazi links. We had no idea about the royal links,
but
it comes as no surprise. The fact that what's pushed to us is inside Bill's brain. Oh, he's just a geek in a garage that come up with Microsoft and, you know, now he's a philanthropist and stuff like that. We're not told about his links to these powerful elite families and bloodlines, and the fact that he's linked to everything from Planned Parenthood to the Nazis to chopping people's heads off.
Yeah.
The days of the royals, you know, this is all left out.
This is something that
it's hard for people to believe.
And it happens at a very early period and is the reason why they're so good at it, because they already know. And I think we're going to come on to this when I talk about Bezos now in a little bit. There's something very particular and peculiar I found about researching the life of Bezos. And I haven't actually printed up any of the research I've done on Bezos. Bezos is someone who I find extremely interesting because of the way his
head is shaped.
Yeah. One of the many signs that something is awry. It is obviously something going wrong here. Bezos is an extremely interesting character. You go back far enough. I went back to like 1700s Finland or somewhere, where his ancestors look like shriveled beans, and his distant ancestors are all called Pedersen.
In my mind, they're all bald. I'm seriously
telling you, these are some of the most boldest people you can imagine, and gummy as well. Like the pictures, they got these really early, like some of the earliest pictures taken on Earth. They must be, and they're the most gummy people I've ever seen. And it was very much like, oh yeah, I can see how they're related. But should we talk about Jeff Bezos? No,
just before we get on to Jeffrey Bezos, do you know anything about Frederick L. Gates? Because we saw this name crop up when we were looking into Spanish flu. But is this just someone else with the surname Gates?
Probably, but like I say, there's so many Gates who have come from this line that you wouldn't be surprised if it's a fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth cousin. At the moment, I'm doing
helped
like
cover up the Spanish flu.
Well, that's brilliant. I tell you what, I will look into him and I will include him within my next part of something I've got. I'm making slowly.
Frederick L. Gates.
Yeah, I'm making something called Controller Virus. And I've gone back to the first time when we started properly doing gain of function research and started to look at the characters who were involved in it, including in Britain, it was a guy called Reginald Farrar. Farrar, of course, Jeremy Farrar, the head of the Wellcome Trust. Yet they're apparently not related, yet he literally mirrors this Reginald Farrar mirrors Jeremy Farrar's life nearly in every single way. Right. Went over to Asia, studied what was viral infections and plague, was heading up philanthropy, working under the Red Cross, working for the Norton Foundation, working for what do they call League of Extraordinary Gentlemen? No, their first iteration of what was the UN was League of Nations, working with really shady societies, shady organizations as well, and was following all of this pandemic stuff that was first kicking off. Died in the 20s, extremely interesting history. And then when you look at each section around the world, you had, for instance, the representative for the Manchurian conferences of 1911, which were studying infectious plague, a viral infection, former plague, not bubonic plague. And people from all around the world went to this seminar. It was like the first time these internationals had met. And in the American representative was a guy called Dr. Strong, and it was the Rockefeller Institute then, even in 1911, who say, oh, it's Dr. Strong's your guy to go across and examine it and examine these dead bodies, see if we can get. They were mixing around play cultures, inventing things, trying to gain a function research, doing tests in really, really early lab environments. And then a few years later, you have the Spanish flu and this other illness which no one talks about, that was, if you ever seen a movie called I can't remember what it's called, it's Robert De Niro, I was about to say Sleepers, but it's not, and he's like plays a guy who's in the hospital and he can't speak, and it's like these people for years they were like a shell.
I have seen it, it was based on a true story.
Yeah, well, this disease existed and disappeared again, and no one knows where it came from. And it came just during this time where all of these virus researchers are suddenly doing all these massive gain-of-function experiments outside laboratory environments with no care for what happens, poking everything with everything, rubbing marmots and bats together with no fear at all. They're just like, let's see what we can get out of this. Let's see how many of us die. They're like lining up prisoners and saying, right, you're all going to be executed, or you can take some of this stuff that we can give you, and if you survive, you can go. And then like these shuffling half dead zombie characters shuffle out the gates eventually, like after the rest have died. It was some really crazy stuff, so I'll look into him during that.
Frederick L. Gates, he helped cover up Spanish flu.
Yeah, and... now there was something dodgy as fuck with Spanish flu. Something really
and,
dodgy.
And he was basically trying to put people off the idea that it was linked to the mass vaccination program that happened.
World War One, just before the American GIs went off, because obviously in the First World War, America joined very late.
Yeah, so this
is about the time they sent them off in like 1917 or something. Can't put a shot then.
That's the thing. You're just seeing the same blueprints again and again.
They learn as well. They learn that they can say, oh, there's a load of guys in muddy trenches in, at war. Of course, there's going to be disease. Of course, disease. But I mean, a lot of these guys were test subjects. The majority, when I did an article about Port and Down and their 100-year history of gassing their own people and killing masses of human population in Great Britain by experimenting on us publicly, you know, getting away with it, being caught over and over again and still getting away with it. Unbelievable. But they were nearly all at the start were targeting army guys. So you'll only hear one or two victims because most of the victims will never be released. But people like Ronnie Madison, who was one of the men who were forced into a gas chamber, you know, and had loads of different experiments. If I remember Ronnie Madison, if this is him, his leg turned completely blue and shattered like glass. Is one of the stories from their experiments. The experiments they were doing at early Port and Down, and that was around the same time they were like, okay, we need to start experimenting on people really quickly. And they went down to Cornwall and they got themselves a little set up there. Same people, though. Same people will come up again and again in these things. So I would have come across him soon because I'm going to be going into the Spanish flu and this other disease. I just can't remember what it's called. And it just disappeared. One day it just disappeared. It didn't have
COVID.
These things, they don't seem to have full stories. They're part stories that then just vanish and fade.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, whether it's Spanish flu or COVID, these things could quite possibly just be psyops. I mean, they are just created fictions. Who's to say that Spanish flu wasn't just the injuries from the vaxes that the soldiers were getting? And who's to say that COVID wasn't just the flu rebranded, and whatever comes next in the form of pandemic two isn't just the injuries from this set of vaxes?
What's weird is if you go back in history, one of the many weird things, if you go back in history through pandemics, before the Spanish flu, there's not really any flus. You've got nothing. You're going through history and you're like we're supposed to all be like just entering this stage where we're traveling across the world and stuff. They're like, maybe that could have been a flu over there, but we don't know. And it was probably this because the description of the illness was well documented.
And it just so happened to come about at the same time that they were doing this mass vaccination program. And where did it start? In the army barracks, where all the soldiers were vaccinated.
Yeah, and where they were testing on people all of the time. Yeah. It wasn't just one thing. Back then, it was... there has to be a lot said about the fact that they've treated us and our ancestors like schmucks for a long time. When my granddad came back from World War II, he had just been sent to Burma, and he had spent most of the days in the jungle playing games with like football and stuff with the locals, and not really doing that much by what I've letters I've read and what I've heard. But he came back and was the first person in this country to be diagnosed with a certain disease. I can never remember if it was called green parrot's disease or blue parrot's disease, but it was one of those parrot diseases. And he was the first person to have this tropical disease, and they said he would die within 6 weeks, maybe a year at the most or whatnot. And he lived into his 70s, and he was a bit of a boy as well, so he lived well into his 70s.
Sounds like monkeypox.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You just don't know. You these things. It seems like, oh, he was sent away and he was in a certain part of the war somewhere and he kept out of the war. That's a very nice narrative. But he came back with a disease, and I wonder how he got that disease, because not everybody who was living out there died of this disease or catches this disease. So it seems always peculiar that it's always the army men back then, and they are just like, they're the guys who have walked through the door and agreed to be killed. they to these aristocrats and to these intellectuals at this point, they're like, this is our test group. This is our subject.
I'm glad that you hadn't heard about the Frederick L. Gates thing, actually, in a sense, because...
Yeah, when we stumbled onto that, when we were researching the Spanish flu and about this inoculation program that made loads of the GIs sick before they went off to serve in the First World War, we were a bit like...
And when we saw the name Gates
saying, this is the guy that said that it wasn't anything to do with the vaccines, it was something called Spanish flu that they picked up in Europe.
Even the name Frederick, I was like... Oh, he's got Gates, isn't he?
He's got to be, surely. I can tell you there's not many, in the lines that I've seen, there's not that many Frederick, but it was extremely popular during the 1800s. So the name just became like one of those, oh, Fred, he's an extremely popular guy.
I mean, just before we get on to Bezos, actually, you know, at the moment, Bill Gates is buying up all the farmland in America. He's part of projects to block out the sun. He's trying to push synthetic meat onto people. You know, like, what do you think, and not to mention his involvement with the WHO and pushing out these vaccines and stuff, you know, what do you think that Bill is up to? What does your heart tell you? What does your gut tell you that Bill Gates is actually planning?
Same kind of thing that Schwab is kind of planning, in a sense. It's a race to partially be known, and not necessarily like known by the masses, but not necessarily in the way that we would think they want to be known. So Schwab is like, he's trying to tick off all of the real Dr. Strangelove's ideas of what's going to be in the future that came through like loads of game theory and planet, like gaming out what would happen in the future. And he's trying to achieve all of these things regardless of the cost. He doesn't care about that. And we see him as some sort of like Bond villain type person. And yeah, he likes that. That's cool for them. That's cool for the rich people. When the rich people see each other, they want to see another Bond villain type person. You're my type of guy ruling over those bloody monkeys down there who don't know nothing, you know. So I think a lot of the projection that he's got is this projection of, oh, look how powerful I am. And it is just a sickness. These guys go into this mode where they can't get out of that sickness. The only way to project their ego and their machismo out is to do things that make them look like evil dictators. Evil dictators.
They want a monopoly over everything.
Yeah, evil dictator does what evil dictator does. You know, they do what they do. Like, you know, they can't stop themselves. And if there's no point, if no one knows, you know, there's no point if you're some meat guy who's doing all of these things in the back. To these guys, that doesn't matter. Those guys do exist, though. We'll talk about one of those guys, about Schwab, the meek people who want to change the world, but only their little sect know that they ever existed, really, and they only know that they were that prominent a person. They don't care what we think. For the elites, they see our type of people, the people who are just common working people. I mean, I'll go out the door. I'm currently in Cardiff. Like, I go out and I see completely normal salt of the earth type people all around where I live. It's a pretty rough area just across the flyover and stuff, and I kind of like that. I kind of like the grimacing look of a hard-fought life. But they see that and they see it as disgusting. They see it as horrible. You know, I see that and I think, oh, people got to make a life for themselves. People have got to try, and not everybody gets the opportunities. For them, it's a disease. We're a disease. We're the maggots roaming around on the corpse, and the good meat is nowhere to be seen.
They have like an Agent Smith from the Matrix perspective on the human species, how you view it.
They don't ever understand why the real people right at the bottom and why they stay at the bottom. They can't understand them, and that detaches them from seeing them as human beings. So for us, the workers and the people who create all of their wealth, we're just tiny little maggots who can just, they could lose a load and it'd be easily replaced with some more. So what's the point?
Well, this leads us on nicely to Bezos.
Yeah, a man who once had nothing, just sitting in his basement, another one just in his basement.
There you go. That's a lie. I'm calling shenanigans on you, Bezos, and I'm coming. I tell
just
you,
another geek in a garage.
Yeah, I've had a couple of sips of root beer now, and I'm like filling up like Popeye and his spinach. Bezos, I'm coming. I'm crawling through the crap of aristocracy and wank, and I'm coming. Bezos annoyed me loads anyway, but someone came along to me and was like, I'll donate you a bit of money if you write an article about Bezos and how he met Ghislaine Maxwell. And I was like, oh, that sounds like an easy enough thing to do. And then I discovered it, and the person really wasn't interested. They wanted to, officially, they wanted to employ my employee to publish the story. But as soon as they found out how they met, they obviously went, oh, God, I should have already worked that out. Oh well, it's not that much of a story. I'm just off now. And so they just went off, and the story never finished. But it was going to be an article that was hard to write anyway, because I started over there looking at trying to find out how he met Ghislaine Maxwell and how they crossed over there, and I ended up in another place completely, like I always do. It's why I never like it when people come along and say, oh, can you investigate this for me, because I will go to the place they want and then I will find the story over there, and it's not often completely related to the original subject, and people are like, oh God, but that's not what I asked. The actual thing I found was much more interesting than the original subject, and yeah, they wouldn't hear me, they wouldn't listen. It's so much more interesting. I will write something up properly about all of the information I found. But basically, Bezos was a very clever young man. He was obviously he was a lucky sort, because he was illegitimate child. He was not really gonna have a good upbringing, and then he got brought into this family, given the name Bezos, and looked after quite heavily. He never got to know his real father, but his real father is someone of influence, and I haven't gone into the family history part of it yet. I haven't delved into that, because I went back quite far. I just haven't investigated each part or looked where they come from. I just found out they come from a load of Scandinavian people who look really gummy and look like they got like those like little doll hair coming out of their faces. So I wasn't very interested in those people. But what was interesting was this start, this birth of the story of who is Jeff Bezos. And I went back to start to read all of the bollocks that was written for the years after, because Bezos' rise to power is not the simple. There was something much murkier and much more dodgy happening before Bezos in 1994 set up Amazon, gave loads of gave his family opportunity to invest in the company very early on, made millionaires of them all, and then had this beautiful journey where he's selling books out the back of his station wagon, a secondhand station wagon he bought together with his wife, where they got no money and they're making it like Americans out there on the road. Jeff Bezos, I think he may have gone to Yale, I can't quite remember. Eventually he got picked up by one of the biggest hedge funds, and the most weirdest of all of the hedge funds in the world, a place called D.E. Shaw. And D.E. Shaw was sat by a guy, I think his name's David Shaw, and he was a professor. I think maybe he was at Yale. You'll have to look into that. Like I say, a lot of this comes with, I'll give you caveats where I'm not sure about something, but D.E. Shaw, I'm sure about. This is like the point where in the 80s, everybody knew, all of these bigwigs, all of these really powerful players knew that the future tech was coming. The internet was right around the corner. Usenet had already been created within the university surrounding. So in the early 80s, you had something called Usenet, which was like the start of the internet. It allowed people at famous educational establishments, military establishments, and other things to communicate on a network of around 600 servers up until like the late 80s, and people, I mean, Usenet is a very strange story in itself. I ended up on that because I was looking into Mencius Moldbug, Curtis Yarvin, who was like a cyber terrorist on Usenet. There were a lot of the cyber terrorist guys came from Usenet. There's a lot to dig away at all of that, because Usenet is now, the archives have been almost completely destroyed and manipulated so that you can barely read them. And some of the big advancements, like the announcement by Tim Berners-Lee of the internet, of the World Wide Web, was made on Usenet. You know, there's a lot of the big posts of the past the problem they have with Usenet is that they all used to post in their own names. So it was under their own names. There was no bot accounts on Usenet. They were all people who worked in establishments and were high up, were all of the people who were in universities, governments, etc. And they used their own name. And it was like, for them, they went through the internet before we even got there. So in the 80s, they were posting, shit posting and all sorts on Usenet, but they were doing it all under their own identities, which meant that they left trails and trails of crap galore once they worked out they shouldn't be talking about most of the things they were talking about on Usenet, and suddenly they just tried to wipe it all away. Google bought it out, made the archives completely unreadable, redacted massive amounts of information. It's a shit show. And it was obvious and clear to all of the people who were making money, the internet is where the money's going to be. The next generation of this Usenet is where the money's going to be. And someone went to David Shaw while he was working as a professor, I think it was at Yale, and he was, if it's not Yale, it's MIT, you know, it's one of those big ones. He was a guy who used game theory, like Herman Kahn, who we'll discuss a little later, to predict the future. And he was amazing at it. And they knew that there would be not many people who would be able to capitalize on the future like him. So they went and they said, you need to set up your hedge fund, you need to set up your organization, and you need to start employing the next generation. And that was what happened, the employment and training in the late 80s of the generation who would own the internet, who would end up capitalizing on all of this. Because to know what was coming and what you needed to do meant that you could own it before and create it before it even got there. It was a form of like tech evangelism, you could call it. And so what you had was Jeff Bezos as a perfect example of one of the candidates for DE Shaw, because you weren't going for a job at DE Shaw. You weren't going to become head of Amazon. You weren't going for director of this company or director of that company. You went to DE Shaw, you told them what you did, and they found the best place to put you, and they put you there, and they made you, they taught you different ways to look at things. The offices of this big financial hedge fund weren't full of people screaming and shouting like all the offices, other offices were. They were all full of people who had, the computer had run all of the variables. They had done all of their background information. They talked quietly and carefully, and they hid everything from everybody else. People were in group sections, separated off, segregated from the start. No one knew what someone else in the next room was doing. And there was loads of projects that appeared to be, like when they're described to you now, missing lots of what was actually happening there, disjointed sort of experiments that sound like something that you would see in like a in a conference for like hotel workers training and conference or something, where they're building something that's never going to be built for to understand the fundamental idea for the future that is needed to be understood before they can take the next step. So there was lots going behind the door. It was the most secretive of all of the hedge funds and financial institutions around at that time. People, there's a lot of reports that come out of there, and it was people saying, you don't even know what's happening. No one knows what's going on there. Everybody's got their own projects. It looked like intelligence. It looks like an intelligence operation to seed in some of the biggest people into power for the next generation of technology that no one knew was going to exist yet. So, for instance, two of the people who I then looked into who were there at the time, one is Jeff Bezos, and the other is, I can't remember his name. He's the guy who invented CNET, the main download platform that still today is one of the most powerful. And at the start was the only place you find all your software, the only place you find all your stuff to download. You know, that was capitalizing on nearly the entirety of the internet straight away. These guys, but Jeff Bezos and this guy were put together as partners at DE Shaw, where the things that are reported out that they did don't seem to be anything of what they did afterwards. And then suddenly, like 1994, he leaves DE Shaw, he gets his station wagon and he fills it up with books, and he's gonna make money by selling books on the internet. And this whole fake story is given to him about being a working American man. You know, they've all of their research into what they want, what is going to happen, why they need to do this in advance, why they need to work out their backstory, why they need to not get caught doing this. I mean, there's all sorts of monopoly laws as well. And this is stuff where they're basically stealing the potential. This new technology had the potential of seeing loads of different businesses come up and be fruitful all together in this sort of like new economy that was going to be created, where everybody could go to any shop. But they knew that that would end up in one big dominant player in each section. So 1994 is the moment when, late 1993, early 1994 is the moment where D.E. Shaw obviously gives Jeff Bezos his wings and says, you will be in charge of this, Amazon. And then he starts creating Amazon, and the investors are on straight away. The whole backstory about him selling books at the back of his car does not function. If you think about it properly, if you think about the size of the company, how quickly it became, within 5 years, he became the richest man in the internet business, like in the tech world, in that sort of area, in tech, entrepreneur of selling stuff online, commerce. So he's like the richest man. He's suddenly, within 5 years, his face is on the front of Time magazine as being the guy who you look up to, who's created this whole business by himself. And they give him constantly, they employ some of the most rubbish writers. Remember, he's setting up this book company, and the one thing they want on Amazon is books about their own creator on there. So they create some real tripe. And all of it, if you research really heavily, you'll discover that it's all slightly wrong. It's all slightly askew, and none of it makes perfect sense. So Amazon was created along with CNET and others inside D.E. Shaw, and was fed to us with a backstory of their creator to say, look, here he is. This is the guy who you could aspire to be, but you can never be that guy. You can never get to be that guy, of course, because he's been selected.
And when you say this is the same case for people like Elon Musk, for example, because we're fed the same story about him.
And the BlackRock and all the investors, and how much money does he actually really own?
Yeah, and Peter Thiel and all of these people who have already got fathers who have done other work before, who have been selected out of probably in through some algorithm that these sick guys have as being genetically superior in
it's intellectually. All through bloodlines.
Yeah.
They're not just someone, like you said, selling books out of the back of their car. This is the story that we're fed time and time again.
Yeah,
could be you if you just work hard enough. No, it couldn't, because if you want one of the biggest companies that's going to have a full monopoly, you're going to have to come from these rich elite family bloodlines. You can't just be a nobody and get to these positions of power. It doesn't work like that, even if we're told that.
Yeah, and you have to have some form of common thread in what your ancestors were interested in doing. So if you're into trade and you're into like conferences and forums, Klaus Schwab's father is very close to his son. He's very close. He set up, like after the war, he set up a trade sort of federation in the local area that he was in. That's very similar to what the World Economic Forum would be if it was a bare bones organization. If you know that someone is going to need to be good, and technologically minded to be successful in something that you're creating in the future, you don't go to a family of people who are chip shop owners or something like that. You go to a family of people who have that in their line, and you're most likely to find the right subject from that.
I know that you're not like you haven't done the same level of research into someone like Elon Musk as you have Bill Gates or Bezos, but do you know a little bit about Musk? Because a lot of people, even in the conspiracy research in circles, consider Elon Musk as like a savior. Oh, he's buying Twitter. He's save free speech. He's
upload us all to the cloud.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like they see him as similar to the way a lot of people view Donald Trump, like they see Elon Musk as a bit of a savior. Is there any kind of light that you can shine on him as a person that could kind of maybe make people open their eyes a little bit more?
Well, I think that what people are getting is exactly is a really perfect, it's almost a perfect projection, a meme-age. You know, he's become a meme for this idea that you can become rich and successful. All I know about Musk from I did start looking into Musk's family tree, and it'll be dirty as hell. It'll be outright, it'll be terrible. I know
his mum's very strange.
His father's very strange. His father, again, like during that era in Germany, you get lots of psychological problems from going up within, because he was in the universities as well as a professor in some areas. So it's kind of like this. I don't like talking about things that I don't know anything about. But
sure, yeah,
Musk,
yeah.
Musk is a walking meme. And
yeah, right.
None of that is ever true. And so I do find it funny, but I also find it really frustrating that people can't say he's the richest man in the world. What is rich and power? They'll take it away from you in 2 seconds if you don't do what they say. So they don't really have any power. And so you don't really have any riches. You just look like you are. He is very much like the dog meme, you know?
Well, similar to like you were saying that Bezos had all these articles put out about him and this propaganda saying, oh, he worked his way up from selling books out the back of the van. I mean, we're told the same thing about Bill Gates. There's this documentary on Netflix that we mentioned earlier, Inside Bill's Brain. And then there's an Elon Musk one that sits next to it that's called Elon Musk, the Real Life Iron Man.
Oh my god, I mean, yeah, but the real life Iron Man, you know, he'd be made of plastic, so it's,
these that's guys... the thing is like the fact that they even have these propaganda documentaries about them that are on things like Netflix are like pushing it out like he is a good guy, like trust us, look, you don't, watch this video on him.
You don't get to be put in a position like Elon Musk where you're in a room when you're a kid and a relative kid deciding to buy into something that's going to be one of the biggest things that is needed throughout the whole of the web without there being, and in my experience, without there being D.E. Shaw in the background. This is how big and important that company is and was to the creation of everything we've got today, is that I think you'll find that the people who put that together were also part of that enterprise to capitalize on every single part of the internet before it had been invented.
So we're kind of focusing in on this episode on these kind of social engineers, these billionaires. We've talked about Gates, and he's linked to the Rockefellers. We talked about Bezos, a little bit about Elon Musk. Is there anyone else you can think of that kind of fits into this category of technocrat or billionaire or like someone else that is having another major part in being a front man and engineering our future, essentially?
Well, I think as soon as you see them, you can't unsee them. But I mean, when you say that, I think about all of these different faces, but in each area it's cordoned off, it's already sorted, you know, like the people who introduce for I did a piece called Welcome Five, which looked at the Welcome Trust, which is like the second biggest fund, I believe, officially, of all medical research in the whole planet. Yeah, it's seen as it's barely seen by normal people, and we have loads of organizations like that. And if you look at the people who are on top of those organizations, you've got your guys, the guys who have been seeded into place. The problem is that we don't realize how many different things are needed to make things work and how many different organizations there are like this. And I spend a lot of time looking into the man Klaus Schwab, that, and I've seen how these people get put into positions in the past as well. And I do get a feeling that you have to have a little bit of luck, of course, there, but you have to be from one of the families. You have to be. So there's going to be a very limited number of people who are at that base level. I say base, where the top of that section of society. But this is the one thing, it's all filtered. Those people are there to make sure that everything, if you can find those people, that's the ones you're looking for, the ones who are right at the top, who everything's got to go through them, and then it they've got some form of control over that information, power, whatever it is that they deal in.
So Klaus Schwab is obviously the head of the World Economic Forum. And to my knowledge, he was also the chairman of the Bilderberg Group.
That dirty little organization.
Yeah, right.
It's intelligence. That's intelligence. That's intelligence agencies coordinating their guys in a little group.
I heard you say that you started investigating Klaus Schwab's lineage and his family tree, and you saw massive gaps like you'd never seen before when you were looking into anyone in the past. So this guy obviously has some real serious stuff to find, because that was quite an abnormality, right?
Or to find or to hide.
That's it. It depends which perspective you're looking for. As soon as you see nothing, you know there's loads of information to fill in. So you know that you're starting from a point of zero. I haven't seen. I'm not exaggerating there. You can't hide everything, but they did a really good job of trying and making it just like one of the most powerful people in the world. And you'd have at most a paragraph that was a same paragraph repeated on loads of different sites. Now, what these people do nowadays to stop you finding out about this stuff is set up loads of sites with that same paragraph on. They're actually extremely lazy people. They'll employ microtaskers or other people. They won't put them much thought into it. Where do you go when you want to actually find out this information? Because you could go to Reddit and see 20,000 different versions of what could possibly be. In actual fact, even places like that, the darker, dirty corners of the internet were like limited on the information. So I'm not sure if that was done really early on, or if they started taking away information. But I think I would err on the side of yes, that was done very early on, because these guys are special. These guys are the top of the technocracy.
Would Klaus Schwab fall into the category, like you said earlier, of someone that wants the power and control and sway, but doesn't necessarily want to be known?
No.
Yeah, right, okay.
Really surprising, because I think that at some point in his past, he had to come to terms with this, that he was a German, officially, though his father once argued that he was actually a Swiss, to try and get this Swiss citizenship back so they could easier run off to South America after the war, because, oh no, who's been working with the Nazis?
Nazis? German passport?
I mean, for the people who don't know, and I can run through this quickly, I discovered that Klaus Schwab's father worked for a company. It took me a long time to discover that he worked for a company called Escher Weiss. He was a manager of their German factory in Ravensburg. It was a company that had two major output, Ravensburg and one in Switzerland. This was before and during World War II. This area, Ravensburg and parts of Baden-Württemberg, got special concessions from the Allies not to be bombed during the war, which is, of course, extremely suspicious if you're saying, oh, yes, bomb everywhere, but not there. Red Cross managed to wiggle that for them. It was also turned out to be the center where they were making the massive heavy water turbines that was required for the Nazi atomic bomb project, which were being created in Klaus Schwab's father's factory in Ravensburg, and then was being shipped up to Norway and used to try and beat the Allies to the atomic bomb, which would of course change the face of the world and would have led to a Nazi victory, or potential Nazi victory during World War II. Possibly the biggest thing that you could find in the past is like this. And his father was called Eugen Schwab. Like, and that can't even be, that's got to be a joke. You know, it got to the point where so it's a Nazi model company. The Nazis used to show like this book, the best Nazi model companies, 1937. 1938. Well, actually, it was like, I think it was either biannual or quarterly, and they would produce a list of companies that were the best, the nuts for the Hitler, like, and they did a really good job during that period, obviously. But after the war, everybody's crapping themselves. And again, this is like an idea of people being seeded from families that are trusted. You don't have to be an American family to be in this situation. You can be a German family or a German Swiss family. And in 1950 onwards, there was a lot of fear with old Nazis that Nuremberg would be relit. You know, a lot of people in Germany and other places, especially in France and the like, were saying, no, we need some form of like real investigation into the horrors that happened. We had this lived experience and you're denying it. But it was like, no, no, slate wiped clean. Don't worry about all of that. You know, all of the murder, all of that. We won't hold anybody accountable apart from the ones who are the big names that we're chasing around. And then the other ones that we've employed and made into heads of our institutions. Now, there's a lot of course, operations like Operation Paperclip and the like that where it was sent in to get Nazi officers. And I don't know if Eugen Schwab was seen as potentially good. There are his rumors have got to me that people said, yeah, he was being looked into, but I've never seen the evidence. So I try not to go by anything that I don't have evidence for. But I like the rumor. It makes sense because by 1964, Eugen Schwab was saying to Klaus, you need to go here directly to this place in Harvard. You need to go to the summer school. For a guy who had worked on the illegal atomic bomb project, that center was also the center and the seminar he would go to, the International Kissinger's International Seminar, was a place which was seeding young leaders into positions all around the world, had been for quite a while, was funded by CIA conduits, including the American Friends for the Middle East, which was headed by Kermit Roosevelt, who was old OSS, had helped form the CIA, did projects to bring down the King Farouk in Egypt in 51-52, and then the Iranian Mossadegh back in 53. These were guys who were overthrowing powers who were funding this project. And the project was created in 1951 with a pilot course. And what it was Henry Kissinger bringing over 50 potential students, young future leaders, future young global leaders back then, who they could then train up to be leaning towards America, filter out the ones that they don't want, find the ones with the best value for what they wanted, and seed them into areas just like Jeff Bezos is seeded by D.E. Shaw. These things I see as being sort of fascist entities hiding what they're really doing behind closed doors, of course. And it's not a surprise it was Kissinger-led. It has so many CIA links. It has so many deep ties to intelligence as well, the project in general. And for Eugen Schwab to say to his son, you need to go to this event over here, then you will be put into contact with two men in particular by Henry Kissinger. You'll be put into contact with John Kenneth Galbraith, who's one of the heads of economics in America. He taught JFK, you know, he was given ambassador to India under JFK, and I think he was serving around that time. And Herman Kahn, the real Dr. Strangelove, who was at the center of working out the atomic bomb project, like the nuclear, the repercussions of nuclear war, of gaming out nuclear holocaust, of the end of days, really, and doing it really well. And he would be sent there to Harvard specifically by his father, where he would be mentored by these two guys and they would go and help him create the World Economic Forum. That is no coincidence. It's something I see over and over and over again. These people who are seeded into positions of power because their fathers did the same thing. So you can trust a son will probably do the same thing. These guys were given loads and loads and loads of like qualifications all over the place.
As you just described with Klaus Schwab's father, you know, it's so similar to what Klaus Schwab is now openly boasting about in terms of his school for young leaders.
I'm currently deep in, like, I'm 6,000 words deep in an article that covers all of these years and what was going on during these years, because it makes a hell of a lot more sense that what you're actually seeing in the World Economic Forum and the creation of the World Economic Forum was in 1966, 1967, Humphrey Dorman had to rumble Harvard. I don't know why he had to do it, but he had to say out loud, look, all of these courses were CIA funded. And the belief is, my working belief is that this was to do with Israel and the war that was to come that would see Israel get suddenly American support flip from being anti-Zionist against the creation of Israel in on the whole to being completely supportive of the state of Israel. And this was a big thing that was happening. And they knew that Harvard had been linked a lot with all of these projects and programs. And that if it came out in the wrong way and it hadn't been petered out in the way it was, that it could make everything collapse. And they needed to recreate this somewhere else. And so 1967, Schwab's leaving Harvard, this international seminar, he admits himself openly. He did not take courses. He attended Kissinger's international seminar. He did not go and do a specific course. He did not graduate from Harvard. He was there at the summer school. He was there at the intelligence-funded event that seeded in multiple leaders, including Pierre Trudeau and others, so Justin Trudeau's father, into positions of power, seeded a Japanese leader into power, other people. It's really hard to find out all of the people who were there because they hid a lot of it, yet they published a lot of it too.
Because I heard you mention that before. It just doesn't make any sense. Klaus Schwab saying, oh, I went to the university, but I didn't study anything in particular. What?
I know.
Why were you there then?
This is the thing about Klaus Schwab that's amazing that you only learn after studying him for a certain amount of time is that he says openly these things that should lead you down this road to investigate this thing because he's just said it and it makes no sense. It's like somewhere I watch people every now and again when like someone's watching Klaus Schwab stuff, I watch them and I see if they've kind of like, if they go like, no one does, you know, no one does. No one looks like, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. What, weigh it up, because we're so used to listen to people say stuff and it being disconnected from us in some way. But if you actually know what it's supposed to create, what are you talking about? You went to a place, by that point, he was being bundled like 12 plus honors and degrees. The most of them, he's turned up at a place, he was officially there for 6 months and they would just throw in an honor at him. He was obviously a golden boy. He was obviously noted. He was obviously one of the select, because in actual fact he says, oh, they kindly let me sit in on the seminar. Well, you didn't pay to go to the international seminar. Of course they let him sit in, because the international seminar candidates were selected usually from about 400 international candidates who would be whittled down to 50 of the leading best minds, and they were advertised from all around the world. So I found adverts in like Lahore magazine in the 50s of them saying, come to Kissinger's international seminar, you've got to be the best you could possibly be about all of your other the other candidates, and you will be whittled down and we will pay everything for you. We will pay your flights, we will bring you backwards and forwards, you will stay there, you will eat, you will be happy. And you will own nothing. And you'll be having, yeah. None of that's written in there. No. And they were seeding that, they were looking for the best from all around the world. They were looking for the best, and they were running them through something that would allow them to see how aligned they were with America, because America was seen as a soulless behemoth that didn't care, didn't have any real ideology backing it up, was just didn't care about its people, didn't care about what it was doing. It was just grotesquely crushing country after country. And they're right, they were right to think that, but they had to find all of the people that didn't think that and had the potential to be seated into these positions of power. So 1967 comes around. One of Klaus Schwab's mentors, Herman Kahn, is just releasing the year 2000, which is the document I talked about earlier, which is like a tick sheet of all of the innovations, massive innovations, paradigm shifting innovations that we expect in the future. And they're already saying, right, we need to make sure we're the ones. Alongside that document, he's releasing an ancillary document at the same time where the Hudson Institute looked at the future development of young global leaders, who they were going to actually be needed to seed into these positions to hold this sort of power and to be able to dole out this sort of power in the future. And more importantly, keep this project going that was set up by William Yandell Elliott, this guy behind the scenes who Kissinger says in like 1951, writes to him and says, everybody thinks it's Kissinger's international seminar, but I think we both know the truth. Because this guy is really the guy behind the scenes. He looks grotesque, advisor to six presidents, the guy you've never heard of at all. I looked briefly in his family tree, and I think he's related to the Trudeau family in some way, but I'm not completely sure about that. It would explain why Pierre Trudeau got in. He was nothing special, why he gets lifted up. But a lot of these people were basically seeded, and then this needed to be created again. So the Hudson Institute had produced this document. Herman Kahn knows that they need to seed young global leaders for the future. It's a big document, this ancillary document, about the future educational leaders needs for young leaders. And then he's a man who goes along with John Kenneth Galbraith over to Europe to convince other people to be involved in the creation of the World Economic Forum under Klaus Schwab, which is going to be called the European Management Symposium, then Forum, and then in the 90s would let out that they're actually a globalist organization. But the plan was there. The plan was there. We need to create something that was actually almost a complete replica of Harvard Summer School. So the World Economic Forum is nearly a complete replica of the government side of Harvard Summer School, of Kissinger's international seminar, and what they do and the type of conferences they do are nearly exactly the same. The policy ideas and the brainstorm is nearly exactly the same. Yeah. Klaus Schwab was creating something that would lead to a much more global version of Kissinger's international seminar. And that's what we saw eventually with the young global leaders. Not a surprise that in 89, 90, we see all of the problems in Europe come to a head because Gorbachev is really just the American man in Russia. He's going to hand over the reins, say, okay, we can't go on any further, bring down that wall, and then everything's already been seeded. Think about that time, that period. At that time, Jeff Bezos and the like are being prepared to be seeded eventually into positions for the World Wide Web. And we got the falling of the Berlin Wall. You know, Klaus Schwab is now looking at creating the thing that they've been looking to create for a long time, the international seminar for young global leaders, his own international, Schwab's international.
Like, it's like he's, it's like prison is the finishing school for criminals.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, all right. It kind of reminds me about Harry Potter, like the wizard school that they all go to.
And they were naive. Yeah, they were naive with it too, like in Harry, like Harry Potter would probably be a bit naive if we expected it to go like that. You can imagine you stick a load of kids with powers there. But these people, they were like, okay, we've got control of the global order now. We spent the 70s creating this, creating our name. We spent the 80s bringing in China and other areas and other players that gives us massive sway over the future because their growth is going to be massive and it means we're aligned with the people who create growth. They're doing what we say so that they can get certain things such as technologies and stuff. They're in a position where they're able to create something new in the 90s. And 92, they start Global Leaders for Tomorrow, which it fails because all of the people ask way too many questions and they start realizing they have to select, a lot like Henry Kissinger's international seminar had to be selected, the best from the political elite and all of this. But by this point, the political elite are a bunch of backbiters. They want any help they can and they get that through this course. So then we have the following year, Young Global Leaders, and that is really the cycle of Kissinger's ambition being created into a proper working organization that can then seed thousands of leaders into positions of power, not only in politics, but also in big business, which I think a lot of people don't realize when they actually look through a list of the young global leaders, of thousands of names that have been collected about all of the people. A lot of the people aren't big leaders. A lot of the people have got blank or unknown what they do next to their name because they are leaders within intelligence, they're leaders within companies where intelligence, you can be in intelligence and get away with it. You're at the top of the funnel, yeah. You're in control. And that's what they're interested in doing, making sure they've already got the game sewn up. Now people are understanding. I mean, I didn't understand until I did all of this research, I didn't understand that they'd sewn the whole thing up years ago. We are in serious danger. These guys have got their finger on the button and some of them are mental, off their face if they think that what they think is going to happen is going to happen. And a lot of this all comes from I mean, the CFR, the creation of this international seminar, that is all partially, you know, Rockefeller funded at the start, the summer school, originally the idea, and the Confluence magazine, for instance, which was set up in 1951 to follow Kissinger's international summer school. You can only find it in printed form. Now, that was funded by the Rockefellers, so we know they had their fingers in that pie. The CFR itself at the time, David Rockefeller was second in charge at the Council on Foreign Relations at that time.
Well, you see how it's all linked. I mean, yeah, it's just the same names, isn't it, again and again? And you're talking about the Rockefellers and, you know.
So where are we now? Where are we now? Where are we now? We're coming up to a point where all of these guys who have been trained to be seated into power, some of them are already retiring. They've been doing this show for so long. You know, Tony Blair was one of those young global leaders. Within three years of being on that course, he was Prime Minister of the UK and would keep his power for, like, what, 10 years or something.
So yeah. The Bilderberg group was like this. You know, you had these people, like you say, someone like Tony Blair or Angela Merkel, or these people that, yeah, these people that at the time would have been unknown. They went to the Bilderberg meetings, and then before you know it, they're in these prominent positions of power, and you realise, oh, although this is, you know, put to the vote, these people are chosen way before it gets to that point.
Well, Herman Kahn says it in 1967. He's saying, you know, you've got to find the right person in this ancillary document that you can find linked into the second Schwab article, the Dr. Klaus Schwab article. It goes through how you have to have a certain type of person who needs to be caught younger to be groomed for power, and the universities, the places where we think the powerful learn their game, will just become kind of school for the people who will be helping to assist these chosen leaders. Yeah. So what we got is a dictatorship. It's a technocracy, a technocratic dictatorship that's set up by a guy whose lifetime leader, that, I mean, Klaus Schwab, if you want someone who's evil, then a lifetime leader of an organization is definitely someone who you would put on your list as potentially being evil.
And he is the kind of epitome of a James Bond style villain.
Yeah, and I think I've written about this. I think that's on purpose. And if what we were talking about earlier is, like, they want to be remembered like that, in that cool way, by all of us, but to their friends and colleagues. I met a couple of people who have been to Davos and who have said, like, it's like they think it's normal. They're just talking away with each other. They think it's normal. But what they're doing there, they know what they're doing there. They just don't take us into account. And while they're in this position where they choose who's next to go into this place, we won't have change. It'll keep being the same moral, ethical dilemmas coming up over and over again that these people don't have a functioning sort of understanding of, because they're so detached from humanity, it seems. I was talking to someone yesterday about Britain. I find it such a peculiar country, because I look around and I just come over from Chile, and there everybody's still in the height of the pandemic. They've all got their masks on. They're walking around, head down. They're still well within it. They're listening to their doctors about nearly everything. Booster shots, booster shots, booster shots. You can't even have a conversation with people. They're right into this dystopian world now. And you come across and you find that no, in the other countries, people are not with it anymore. They've moved on and they've gone on. And in Britain, it's a very special, unique situation. And someone was saying that we'll never revolt. Someone was saying to me the other day, we'll never see revolution anymore in Britain. We're not the type of people to do that. But all around the world, they're looking to collapse this world on purpose as well. This isn't a conspiracy. I mean, this is just, you can see it now. You can see it happening, and we will experience it within our lifetime. And I think Britain stands in a very special place, and it's always been really important. If someone complains in Britain, they'll stop doing the thing. pretty quickly, they'll be like, oh yeah, yeah, let's not rock the boat too much, because this is a really important boat not to rock. When revolutions have come from Britain, they've been revolutions that have exported all across the world. And when innovations have been made in Britain, they've been innovations that have exported all across the world. They've been viral in the way they've been exported across the world. It's a very special country of 60 million people who all squash together and are all saying stuff randomly, and it comes out with these massively important changes to human society and how we live together, and understanding human society and how we live together. And if you go back to all of these people in charge and all these people get seeded into power, most of them ended up being seeded some way by British influence. You know, the CFR was just a copy of Chatham House, etc. You go back, Rhodes and his idea about creating something that is basically the British Empire with America attached. And then eventually Herman Kahn said, well, the best thing is if we have America and Britain in the Union, and then we bring in Europe, and then no one can argue with us. And now it's globalism, you know. But inside that global structure, you've got all of these little countries that have all these different historical like moments where they sparked up, and you saw how their people revolted to a situation. So you'll see the heads getting chopped off in France, or you'll see mayhem and start of communism in the Soviet world. You see all these different things, but Britain's a really special one. I think they change their mind and they ease up restrictions and stuff much quicker in this country, because when a revolution comes from this country, it completely and utterly destroys their plan. It has the potential to completely and utterly destroy everything. The people who wrote about and warned us about all of this stuff, even though some of them were involved in it because they were mates with all of these people, they were all British. They were all there in this cooking pot. They were all there to say, look, and here I got a Orwellian t-shirt on right here with the insert exactly. There. Yeah. It's like you from the off, people in this country sniff a rat and they're quick to it, and every country's got the things that they're good at. Britain's very good at revolution in a different way. So I think Britain was right on the edge of a revolution. The
vendetta.
Yes, all of change emanates from the point when the pressure releases, and the English language, I think, has allowed us to release the pressure over and over. It's been a headache for a lot of people, and it's why that a lot of the center of power of the original power can be traced back here, especially with things like royal family and the way politics works and the way government is.
Even with Gates, which I think we are both pretty surprised by, it all links back to our small little island.
Yeah, a very strange little place where I try and explain to people that, you know, if it's both the place you don't want to be and you want to be at the same time. It's a very strange little world. And if you go out onto the streets and talk with the everyman, you wouldn't even know that any of this was happening, because most people are keeping to themselves. As soon as they're ready to take something in, it is everywhere and everybody reacts. And this is a country where they're always, this is a bellwether country. I think we're very lucky to be here, but if you look at all of the arsehole in the world, nearly all of it also comes originally somehow from this little island.
I think we can leave it there. I don't want to keep you for too much longer.
I know I've got to get on to certain investigations soon, because they're obvious, talking
Elon
about
Musk,
people like,
come on.
Yeah, I know, Elon Musk, people like that. It all takes a hell of a lot of time.
Zuckerberg, I mean, is Zuckerberg even human?
I honestly, that's one I wouldn't even bother trying, because I can't be sure. Who can?
All the information for Zuckerberg is on the Metaverse video. Everything you need to know about him.
If you trace Zuckerberg back, you're going to get to Data from Star Trek.
Well, I think you're just going to get to binary code. it's all zeros and ones, man, all the way down. In a couple of months, I will be able to talk about some stuff which is just completely and utterly through the looking glass. I mean, really crazy stuff. I'm also researching an era, a time in London's history at the moment that not many people know this events, but they don't know all of the events.
Okay,
and contain some of the most interesting and intriguing people who were involved in everything from gangland supremacy to Satanism. And it's just the most bizarre thing. If that gets cleared for publication, which I don't know if it will, because I'm on the fifth part of this series, and I'm like, I don't even know if this is, I don't even know if people want to know this.
But even if it's not, it's something that we can talk about.
So. Yeah, most definitely. Listen, there's loads more. I mean, while they keep me alive, then there's loads more. I don't know how long that's gonna last
before the bullet comes through the window.
Yeah. Well, I got skylights, so let's see them trot our drones. Yeah, no, it's a crazy world, man. It's a crazy world. So hopefully I'll still be around, but I'm happy to come back and talk about anything that I know about.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of The Schism. We've got plenty more episodes on the way. In the meantime, follow us on our Instagram at schism.tv and keep watching the skies.